Adjustment Assistance Community College and Career Training Program. In 2012, Henry Ford Community College received a $15 million grant known as the TAC grant and became the lead college of a 15-college consortium. And as I stated earlier, the official name for the grant is Trade Adjustment Assistant Community College and Career Training Program, known as TAC. The purpose of the consortium is to develop a new training format that will give employers trained workers to staff the huge work gap known as the skills gap. The grant is new and is addressing new concepts and ideas in manufacturing and the training of manufacturing skills. During the next series of impact programs, we hope to help the WHFR listener learn more about this program and the impact on the metro area. The authority that administers this particular grant is the United States Department of Labor and the Employment and Training Administration Department. The TAC program is described as a collaborative operation of the two federal departments. The target population for this training are the unemployed or underemployed. During the program, we will have the presentations of different stakeholders in the area of the skills gap. The objective is to help you understand what is skills gap and how the TAC grant is addressing the problem. Academic Program Manager Catherine Wrench and Industry Program Manager Scott Gelady share the responsibility as HFCC's leadership role of the consortium. They chair ongoing weekly meetings and teleconferences with the consortium of academic partners. There are also meetings with the corporate partners. During one of these weekly meetings, Catherine shared how everyone meeting the corporate partners want to hit the ground running. And she says that is the challenge of the college partners they have in meeting the skills gap training and training the number of students the college has coming up in the manufacturing program. She went on to say that there needs to be a change in the public and student perception of the new advanced skills required for the manufacturing industry, along with training workers for the digital technological environment. Community colleges and other two-year program trainings were earmarked for the grant. Impact will be covering the various areas of the TAC grad program in the next up and coming programs. During this program, we will share with listeners presentations from various stakeholders of the grant itself and working to address what we mean by the skills gap problem. After the first audio presentation, we get a chance to hear some of the discussion of it from the academic partners during one of their academic teleconferences. The goals of the TAC program are to increase attainment of degrees, certification, certificates, diplomas, and other industry-recognized credentials. Two, to introduce or replicate innovative and effective methods. And three, to improve or demonstrate improved employment outcomes. With TAC, the department is interested in increasing the leveraging of advanced training technologies that go beyond the traditional online education and accelerate learning and credential attainment through a variety of means. And now, Mike Rowe, who is the host of the Discovery Channel program, is called Dirty Jobs, is making a presentation before the Senate Committee as he describes at what he sees as the skills grant. And now we have a Mike Rowe.
Mike Rowe is the creator and executive producer and host of Discovery Channel's Dirty Jobs.
That's true.
My wife thinks you're terrific.
Your wife has excellent taste, Senator. Thank you. Give her my regards.
I will.
And thank you officially for having me here today. It really is a thrill and an honor. One small thing, the credits for the show are very kind. In truth, I'm more of a guest. I assume the role of an apprentice on Dirty Jobs, and for the last 7 years or so, I've traveled to every state and worked in just about every industry with people you would otherwise never get a chance to know. They're anonymous folks, many times in small towns you wouldn't find on a map, who do the kinds of jobs that make civilized life possible for the rest of us. In the history of TV, it's probably the simplest show ever, but there's some very big themes that run through Dirty Jobs. And over the last 6 or 7 years, I've personally had a front row seat, and I've watched the headlines catch up to a lot of those themes. Thus, the simplest show in TV has become interesting in a way that I never anticipated or intended. I could talk certainly at length about any of the people I've met in the show, and I'm tempted to, but I'd rather take a small portion of my 5 minutes and tell you about my grandfather, because he's the reason ultimately that I decided to come here today. His name was Carl Noble, and he made his living in Baltimore as a master electrician. He was also a plumber and a mechanic, mason, carpenter. Everybody knew him as a jack of all trades. And I remember him mostly as a magician. For most of his life, my granddad woke up clean, and he came home dirty. And in between, he accomplished some things that were nothing short of miraculous to me. Some days he might reshingle a roof or rebuild a motor, run electricity, you know, out to the barn. He helped build the church that I went to as a kid and the farmhouse that I grew up in. Basically, he could fix or build anything, but to my knowledge, he never once read the directions to anything. He just knew how stuff worked. I remember one Saturday morning when I was 12, I flushed the toilet in the same way I had been flushing it for 12 years. The toilet, however, responded in a way that was completely out of character. There was a rumbling sound followed by a distant gurgle, and then everything that had gone down reappeared in a rather violent and spectacular fashion. Naturally, my granddad was called in to investigate, and within the hour, I was invited to join he and my father, who's right behind me there, out in the front yard for about 12 hours of forced labor. There was pipe welding, and there was picks, and there was shovels, and there were blisters and laughter and maybe some questionable language. But by sunset, we were completely filthy. The new pipe was installed. The dirt was back in the hole, and our toilet was back on its best behavior. And it was one of my favorite days ever. 30 years later in San Francisco, my toilet blew up again. And this time I didn't participate in the repair process. I just called my landlord, and I left a check on the kitchen counter, and I went to work. And when I came home, the mess was cleaned up and the problem was solved. As for the actual plumber who did the work, I never even met him. But it never occurred to me to meet him. What did occur to me that day was the fact that I had become disconnected from a lot of things that really used to fascinate me growing up. I no longer thought about where my food came from or how my electricity worked or who fixed my pipes or who made my clothes. I didn't think about who made anything. There was no reason to. I was less interested in how things got made, in fact, and more interested in how things got bought. Well, at this point, my granddad was well into his 80s. After a long visit with him one weekend, I decided to do a TV show in his honor. Now, today, Dirty Jobs is still on the air, and I'm here before you guys hoping to say something useful. So here it is. I believe that we need a national PR campaign for skilled labor, like a big one. Something that addresses the widening skills gap head-on and reconnects the country with the most important part of our workforce. Right now, American manufacturing is struggling to fill 200,000 vacant positions, I'm told. And there are 450,000 openings today in trades, transportation, and utilities. The skills gap seems real, and it's getting wider. In Alabama, a third of all skilled tradesmen are now over 55. They're retiring fast, and there's really nobody there to replace them. Alabama's not alone. A few months ago in Atlanta, I ran into Tom Vilsack, our Secretary of Agriculture. Tom told me about a governor he knows who was unable to move forward on the construction of a new power plant. The reason I thought was fascinating. It wasn't a lack of funds or a lack of support. It was a lack of qualified welders. In general, people are surprised that high unemployment can exist at the same time as a skilled labor shortage, but they shouldn't be. We've pretty much guaranteed it. In high schools, the vocational arts have all but vanished, and we've elevated the importance of higher education to such a lofty perch that all other forms of knowledge are now labeled as alternative. Millions of parents and kids see apprenticeships and really valuable on-the-job training opportunities as vocational consolation prizes, best suited for those not cut out for a four-year degree. And still, we talk about creating millions of shovel-ready jobs for a society that doesn't really encourage people to pick up a shovel. In 100 different ways, I think we've slowly marginalized an entire category of critical professions, reshaping our expectations of a good job into something that no longer looks like work. A few years from now, an hour with a good plumber, if you can find one, is going to cost more than an hour with a good psychiatrist, at which point we'll probably all be in need of both. I wanted to come here today because guys like my granddad are no less important to civilized life than they were 50 years ago. Maybe they're in shorter supply today because we don't acknowledge them the way that we used to. We leave our check on the kitchen counter and hope the work gets done. Well, that needs to change. My written testimony includes the details of several initiatives designed to close the skills gap, all of which I've had the privilege to participate in. Go Build Alabama, I Make America, my own modest efforts through Dirty Jobs and Micro Works. I'm especially proud, though, today to announce Discover Your Skills. It's a broad-based initiative from Discovery Communications that I think can change perceptions in a really meaningful way. I encourage you to support these efforts because closing the skills gap doesn't just benefit future tradesmen and the companies who are desperate to hire them. It benefits people like me and anyone else who shares my addiction to paved roads, reliable bridges, heating, air conditioning, and of course indoor plumbing. Something for all of us to consider perhaps during the next bathroom break.
ABC Associate Director of Global Learning provide some support to the TAC grantees. Can you advance a few, please? I just want to give some context for this program because I think that unlike many other OER initiatives, this one has a real strategy. And it's strategy, I think, that is one of the most compelling aspects of this program. Sorry. Okay. So here's the context in which this program got started. Of course, as we enter into a global economy, there's a whole set of positives associated with it. Lower prices, higher efficiency, more jobs, quality goods. A lot of that, though, is based on foreign trade, offshore outsourcing, imports. And that process generates some negatives. So you've had some displaced workers, some unemployment, lower wages, people who have previously done work that is of a low or obsolescent skill level are being displaced, and that creates some personal and family hardship. And it's because of that that the Department of Labor recognized that some economic adjustments were required and started this program. So here's the actual Economic Adjustment Grant Program. This is a very large program. $2 billion of funding is being provided over a four-year period. It started in 2011. We've just finished the third round of grants to colleges. The grants are going to colleges to expand the actual education and career training programs that could be made available to these displaced workers. They have to be programs that can be completed in 2 years or less, and they have to help people get credentials and get skills that can move them into these high-growth industry sector where there's job opportunities in the various states across the U.S. And a real compelling and interesting aspect of this program is that everything that the curricula that the community colleges develop has to be licensed with a Creative Commons CC BY license, making it open education resources. So this program actually is the largest OER initiative in the world. Here's some of the specific language from the actual call for proposals that the Department of Labor puts out that talks about the requirement for it to be open education resources and CC BY. I think this language is interesting in the sense that it could easily be adopted in other countries and included in similar requests for proposals around developing curricula elsewhere. But you can see that essentially the license is intended to allow others to copy, to distribute, to transmit, and adapt the material that grantees are creating as part of their program offering and that the whole purpose of this is to ensure that materials developed with these funds have maximal reuse potential. Go ahead, Kimmel. So, and just to finish that, it's new content that grantees are developing or materials that are being modified with grant funds. So every bit of new content and all modifications have to be shared. There is, though, this this acknowledgement that some grantees are going to actually purchase materials, or that there may be pre-existing curricula that's not being modified. Those things don't have to be Creative Commons licensed and don't have to be OER. In the third round of the call for proposals, they actually also included some requirements for open file formats. And there's now some language in there as well that deals with if you're using funds to create software, it has to be licensed as open source software. This is a really interesting program by the federal government here in the US that is got open written all over it. I wanted though to also show you some of the complexities around this program and what it's requiring from community colleges. Community colleges are being asked to partner with employers and industry. So the requirement is for community colleges to not develop these credentials on their own, but to actually work with employers who have high growth opportunities where there are employment needs, and to design actual employer-sponsored work-based training models. So it's not a community college working on its own, it's actually working in partnership with employers, which we heard a call for in this morning's keynote. The other interesting thing is that most of the grants are going to consortia of community colleges. So community colleges having to work in partnership with each other, either within a state or across multiple states. And then they're also required to partner with their local public workforce system. So that would be job centers, the local investment, workforce investment board, career and education, career and technical education training agencies, those kinds of entities within the state. So some big partnership requirements associated with this initiative. And then there are six core elements that the Department of Labor is looking for community colleges to integrate into the curriculum they create. They're supposed to use evidence-based design, create what are being called stacked or latticed credentials. They have to actually deal with and ensure transferability and articulation. They're encouraged to use online and technology-enabled learning, and it has to be strategically aligned to community and state needs. And as the grants are being awarded year after year over 4 years, you're supposed to align and build on previously funded TAC projects. It's a fairly complex set of requirements, not just here's some money, go create a credential. You're actually having to do quite a lot of prep work and planning and coordination of partnerships.
At this point, I would like to stop and give the listener another little overview of some of the things that are specific to the state of Michigan and its realities around the skills gap challenge and some of the resources and the potential that Michigan has of addressing this particular problem. We'll begin with a excerpt from the seminar that was presented to the Michigan State colleagues by Carolyn Hatch, who is a fellow from the University of Windsor, and she was making a presentation to Michigan State fellows regarding the challenge of the skills gap problem with the state of Michigan, and also the resources and potential that we have in meeting the situation. And now here's Carolyn.
So why does manufacturing matter to the state's regional economy? Well, the auto industry's mass production methods invented in Michigan were the core of the 20th century industrial revolution. As well, manufacturing employs 10% of the state's workforce, over 500,000 people in the production of automobiles and their parts, metals and machinery, breakfast cereal and other foods, furniture, plastics, as well as many other highly innovative sectors producing goods for global markets. Manufacturing constitutes 30% of Michigan's economic production, more than twice that of any other sector. As well, manufacturing workers enjoy a significant wage premium over their non-manufacturing counterparts, with an average annual salary of over $75,000 per year, which is nearly $25,000 more than non-manufacturing workers. The bulk of research and development in the economy also happens in the manufacturing sector. According to the Michigan Manufacturing Association, Michigan is second in research and development spending behind California and first in industrial R&D intensity in the country, with more than 85% of the North American automotive R&D occurring in this state. Finally, manufacturing small to medium enterprises are the backbone of Michigan communities. Again, according to the Michigan Manufacturing Association, Michigan's manufacturing industry contributes more than $1.5 billion annually towards educational, cultural, human services, and other community building efforts. So I'd like to turn now to, as I mentioned in my introduction, a really important trend that's being observed in both policy and academic circles, and that is the return or the repatriation of manufacturing activity that was once outsourced to other economies back to the U.S. Several U.S. firms, including Caterpillar, GE, and Ford, and others, have announced that they're shifting some manufacturing operations back to the U.S. because of increasing production and energy costs overseas. As for the states that are creating the most manufacturing jobs, the chart shows the ranking here, with Michigan on top and well ahead of other states for job creation between December 2009 and March 2013, with over 88,000 jobs being created in the sector in Michigan during this period. So what's starting to happen here is that multinational corporations that had formerly outsourced their supply chains and production networks to emerging economies are beginning to recalculate their production costs. And in so doing, they're starting to consider a new set of factors that influence where companies invest in new manufacturing capacity. For example, the wage gap between the U.S. and key competitors is narrowing. All over China, wages are climbing at 15 to 20% per year because of the supply and demand imbalance for skilled labor. And some of the other important factors that are shaping these locational decisions of firms include things like supply networks, financial, tax, legal, and regulatory systems, speed to markets, and intellectual property protection. And these factors that might incentivize a return to the U.S. will undoubtedly vary by both firm and industry. For example, industries that rely on intellectual property are drawn to the stronger protection and the more robust regulatory framework offered by the U.S. after, for example, experiencing the challenge of piracy elsewhere. And other firms have found that long supply chains in Asia add cost and reduce flexibility to serve customers in North America and Europe. Others seek access to the cutting-edge U.S. automation and robotic technology. So these are but a few examples of why firms are being drawn back to the U.S. And research on skilled trade job openings by state from February to May 2012 shows that Michigan tops the list with 2,029 openings. And I think that this finding complements previous findings on Michigan's lead in manufacturing job creation in recent years, which I showed on an earlier slide. Finally, research on talent demand in one specific occupational category, CNC machinists, from January to September 2012, shows that the highest demand is coming from MSAs in the Detroit area. And these findings point to the nature and extent, as well as the severity of the skills gap problem in Michigan, where manufacturing constitutes a higher percentage of Michigan's economic base compared with other states. So when thinking about solutions to the skills problem, my review of the literature and my interviews with key regional stakeholders in the state of Michigan shows that there's not simply a one-size-fits-all approach, but rather there's many different models out there from which we can learn. And what these successful models have in common is that they often involve collaborative partnerships between employers and other regional actors, whether they be government agencies or training providers, industry associations, local economic developers, or unions, community organizations, and so on. And they also entail an alignment of efforts to develop talent locally in order to meet long-term industry and community needs. And in the workforce development context, the term that's often used is cluster, in that these efforts are explicitly regional in scale, and they're dependent on the geographic proximity of different institutions and actors in the regional economy and supply chain. So research shows that these types of public-private cluster partnerships have emerged throughout the U.S. in response to the skills gap problem, and in a variety of forms, and often consist of local broad-based community initiatives that focus on talent development through a wide array of innovative programs. And I'm going to talk about just a handful today.
Skills gap, right? Isn't that what they call it in America, where even with this big unemployment we have, there are lots of companies who are begging for people to take good jobs, and then the kind of jobs that kids today don't want to take, and you know why.
Yeah, well, they were begging years ago. Now they're somewhere between pleading and desperate. I mean, it's really gotten to the point where...
Like what companies and what jobs?
...under of many educational ventures, you grew up in a rural setting, so you understand both rural and urban issues for our state, and you also sit around a corporate table and hear the issues regarding the workforce. So what do you think about the educational system and this partnership with employers? And how can we strengthen that in ways that rebound positively for all people of Michigan?
Thank you, Luann. First of all, the system, I think we all have to realize the system is what it is, and it's probably time out to put blame in terms of who did what, and just understand it is what it is, and we all have to understand what our needs are as funders as well as corporations. And from General Motors' perspective, we evaluated the educational system here in Michigan and really in the country, and realized that our company is obviously a global company. We're now competing for talent on a global basis. But of course, we're headquartered here in Michigan. We're headquartered here in Detroit. So when you look at our educational system here in Michigan and in Detroit, we realize that in order for General Motors as a company, for our name to rise to the top, for individuals literally all over the world to view General Motors as a company in a very positive way, that we also have to change the education community in the state of Michigan. So we realized that there was a major gap when it came to STEM, which is one of the areas that we recruit from, obviously. When you look at the manufacturing industry and what was required 20 years ago versus what's required now, from a battery technology perspective, from a hybrid technology perspective, in the entertainment community, all of the needs, manufacturing 20 years ago versus what it is today is like night.
Each week, Catherine Wrench and Scott DeLetti, who are a part of the Corporate Training Department at Henry Ford Community College, they hold teleconferences with the members of the 15 Community College Consortium with the grant that they received from TEC. Following are excerpts from these particular meetings, which will begin to give you an insight or a look at how this particular grant is being operationalized within the consortium led by Henry Ford Community College.
Give me this overview because I really needed to hear what you had to say, which is kind of brings me up to speed as to what's going on as well, and I want to be able to do the same thing for our listeners. Is if I'm hearing you correctly, Nissan had a request where they wanted to hit the ground running. So in hitting the ground running, you're getting a lot of informational kinds of things, and I'm hearing challenges that you know very aptly describe. I feel, how would your experience, how's that being translated with your other academic partners, and what kinds of things are you getting out of that, or are they getting out of that as well from what you're experiencing?
Well, everyone wants to hit the ground running, Betty, and that's the challenge that we have with the skills gap and with the number of students that we have coming into the manufacturing program, and even the perception, you know, that the public has of what it is like now inside working inside the plant, or what it is that you're expected to know, or what the skills are to even tackle the curriculum.
Okay.
Are the challenges that we face now in feeding the pipeline for the industries that need these workers.
Okay.
And there are jobs, and we've got to get these students through the programs faster. And, of course, the challenge is balancing education and credentialing what our needs are. And we know what these students have to know in order to perform the task. Industry set out and said, okay, here's what they have to do, but here's what you have to know in order to do that.
Okay.
And so that's where the challenge comes into play, and we can't send the students through in 2 years and say, well, here's the finished product. We've got to know along different points along the pathway as to whether or not they're meeting the goals, you know, that we have, because when you get to the end of the line, industry doesn't work that way anymore. You've got to check that product before it gets to the end of the line.
Right. Okay.
And so our challenge is to match in our processes even what it is that, you know, what it is that our customers are calling quality, what our students are getting out of our programs, what industry wants out of our programs, and then modifying our processes in education to match what our customer needs are.
Okay. And what has been the feedback from Nissan thus far?
So far, they are in it for the long haul. They recognize that they're kind of an early representation of industry wanting this. In the past, we've done special industry classes, and somebody mentioned this earlier, I think it was Steve, identifying ways to get credit for that special industry. Even now, our school, as well as many of the other schools in the consortium, they're providing training, but are they going to get credit out of that? So I think that Nissan's not only motivated to find additional ways to train current and prospective employees, they're really interested to see the educational side of this. Hey, how is this going to transfer into credit so that their employees and the prospective ones can show credentials?
Okay, now I'm going to hold up. I know I'm at...
So we go through, and we teach this cohort of 24 students. We'll just call them the Nissan class right now.
Hi, how are you?
my name is Mike Franklin. I am one of the Innovation Team 2 co-leaders and a facilitator for Bluegrass Community and Technical College. Our college is one of 16 colleges in the state of Kentucky that belongs to a community and technical college system.
Okay.
Another one of our colleges, Jefferson, is also involved in this grant. Our partner, our industry partner, is Toyota Motor Manufacturing of Kentucky, which is located in Georgetown, Kentucky. Bluegrass College is located, the main campus, in Lexington, Kentucky, but we have several additional satellite campuses, and one of those actually resides right outside the fence of Toyota, and it's called the North American Training Center.
Okay.
North American Production Training Center. Toyota was involved early on in helping formulate the Amtec curriculum. We have industrial maintenance and service maintenance technician training going on at Toyota, which we're trying to improve and then spread into our other technical training areas at the college. We are both academically and industrial partner, still believe that there is a way to enhance and accelerate the skills training that industry desires.
Okay.
And now it's a matter of how we all get on board nationally and make that work.
Okay.
And I'll stop there and open myself up for questions.
Hi, this is Norm. I'm with Bridgemont Community and Technical College in West Virginia, which is in Charleston, and we've got a pretty wide-ranging area. We've got some pieces that are kind of urban, and a lot of our service area gets out into some pretty rural stuff. So we've got a very commuter-based set of students, which has some interesting aspects. Sometimes the city kids can get in no problem, and the other guys are buried under 3 foot of snow. Right now, we're working with primarily Toyota, but we've actually got a number of opportunities rolling around. That we've got some apprenticeships. We started with Gestomp. They're very interested in bringing their new people online as soon as possible. So a competency-based curriculum would work out really nicely for them. Right now, our efforts with Toyota and some of the other chemical industries in the area have been more cohort-based, and they're pretty happy with that at the moment, so we might actually have a little bit of trouble getting people to accelerate. One of the things I think they're trying to do is build the whole cohort team feel. And we've got a pile of irons in the fire. We've got this grant, the follow-on to this grant. We're bringing up a new ATC just outside my window, putting in a nice new special place for the simulator, and we're merging two colleges. So it should be a good year for us getting bored.
Okay.
And I'll stop at that point.
Okay.
It's like, look, I'll give you the short version. We have 26 positions available right now for heavy equipment technicians. 26. These start 40s, 50s, but with a couple years' experience, you're $120,000. Can't fill them, right? These aren't vocational consolation prizes. These are real jobs at a real company, and they can't fill them. And that's just one company and one dealership.
But why? It's because kids don't think that those are good jobs, right?
First of all, this is all beyond my pay grade. I have a theory, and it's based only on the 50 states I visited and the 300 jobs I did and the people I talked to, but it's a theory.
Slightly more than what I'm basing it on.
No, look, when the dust settles, nobody's talking about the overarching sort of disconnect between the educational system that we have, the employers that we have, the kids that we have, the parents that they have, the guidance counselors that we have, and the students that they advise. And that gap is really the place between blue and white collar work. And it's into that gap that about 3 million jobs have fallen. And the reason I think that they're unloved is because we teach our kids almost, I never say indoctrination in any other context, but we almost indoctrinate them to avoid a whole category of perfectly legitimate occupation.
I'm Joel Malinsky. I'm at Henry Ford Community College, and I'm sitting in this office with Catherine, and Scott is next to her. And The location is Dearborn, as you know, and the industrial partners that we are working with, a list that I can't currently remember, but in the implementation of the features of the grant, one of our earliest adopters is a cohort from GM's battery plant down in Brownstown. They're pioneers. Other pioneers that we have in the application of Amtec are a number of Detroit area manufacturing companies through the MAT-2 project, and I would be challenged to remember them all, but we have approximately 8 manufacturing companies from Detroit Diesel, now only known as Detroit, and another group called ZF, another group called Proper. We have New Center Stamping. We have students from EMAG, and I'd be certainly leaving any out. Scott, please jump
Coastal.
In. Oh, that's right. Coastal isn't a part of our cohort.
Okay.
We have approximately 13 students divided up between 8 different companies.
Okay.
And they're actively involved now, just finishing out their second 7-week period of study where a good 85% of the curriculum is being delivered using Amtec support materials.
All right. One of the things I'm going to do in this particular discussion, because I came in late, and I know people's time is precious. What I'm going to ask each one of the people that are part of this discussion is, what have you seen if your students are involved at this time? And I heard that each one of the ones that are on this discussion, you are actually working with students in some form or matter, either in the industry or in some type of curricular program. Is that correct?
Sure.
Okay. All right. What seems to have been, and I'll start from the person that came in, that spoke last, and then we'll back around, because I want to kind of like give each of you like two to three minutes. And excuse me if I have to cut in, but I want to make sure I get everybody a chance to talk and stay within my time frame. But the question again then, what have you seen as to be the milestones or the impact of the students coming into the program, and how do you see, all right, let's just go first with that, and then if I have time, I'll come back with another question. So what are some of the milestones or some of the key learning things or, you know, things that you're seeing that's happening, that the program is dealing with this type of new type of training? So what are the milestones?
Your screen appears to be frozen. Paul, are you there?
There, with the microphone open, then it sounds like I've got Space Invaders landing.
Okay,
so.
All right, okay. So what are some of the key things that seem to be happening with your students or that as far as the program?
Some of the key things we're going through right now are we're looking to start piloting some of the classes. We're building up force to get consensus on doing some of the major industrial certifications.
Mm-hmm.
We seem to have a little resistance on the academic side as far as wanting to do that. So it's just kind of overcoming that resistance
for the students.
And then
go ahead.
We're getting ready for a fall launch of our advanced manufacturing process program, which is Amtec curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
So that's
okay.
Some of the things we're up to.
All right, and next person.
Betty, I was trying to think just recently. Of course, my primary, Denso, Tennessee, is committed to the concept of cooperative education.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the models that we've had, and Scott and Jill and I, not too long ago, were down in Murfreesboro, some plant, and this concept of 2 days of school and 3 days of work or 5 weeks of school and then 5 weeks of work. But anyway, cooperative education is, I use it with a couple of industries out here, primarily the National Lab at Oak Ridge. But I'm starting to see more interest in doing that because what I'm hearing from the employers is they're having a hard time getting people just in the door that are interested in the work. So we're trying to work out a cooperative education model that allows us and go to school at the same time. And I had success with that with other organizations. It'll become the model for how we offer and present the coursework we have here. Okay. Things I do like is the president of this college on the steering committee. He's 100% behind this. As a matter of fact, I had a phone call from him earlier today, and he wants to go see one or two other community colleges that already have a place as far as the lab arrangements and things like that. So okay. We have a new space built to us that we're going to remodel.
Okay.
And just want to make sure that our college is representative of what the latest, greatest in technology and technology offerings are.
Okay. All right.
He's 100% behind the competency-based model of education.
Now, as to have you met your goals and what you see your next step being with your current partners?
Stephen, let's start with you. That is a good question because, honestly, I don't know how to answer it. The relationship that Danville Community College has had with Goodyear has been a long-standing one. And about 15 years ago, Jeff Arnold and Gerald Sexton developed a model for training with Goodyear's assistance and approval to quickly get students in and out taking various courses in industrial maintenance.
Okay.
So what we are hoping and are relatively sure that's going to happen is that once, with the assistance of the grant and acquiring the trainer, and using the competency-based model in addition to the online and blended learning modules that are available through Amtech, and Danville Community College has been involved with Amtech since the beginning.
Okay.
And, so myself that's and several other instructors, including Gerald Sexton.
Okay.
Developed modules for that curriculum.
I think things have been going well. Interestingly, I think our partners are kind of as old-fashioned as we are. In many cases, they will have hours associated with skills also, though they do have their goals. When we started working with Toyota, our goal was to get everything rolling as quickly as possible, the fast on the ground. So we've actually got an aligned curriculum implemented now, and then once we get the trainer and stuff in, we're planning on switching over to the Amtech stuff.
Okay.
And that's been our long-term goal the whole time.
Okay.
I'm also hoping a lot of that stuff relates to a lot of our other partners to pull some of the Amtech stuff for, like, electronics and instrumentation tech training with our chemical process programs.
Okay, and then...
And that's pretty much what we're doing.
Okay.
Grass and our partner, Toyota, I think we have a real good relationship, and we know where we're going and what we want to do. The industry side of it, Toyota, is forging ahead with or without us, and so now it's just a matter of, can the academic side catch up, adjust, change our administrative policies to where we can actually provide what industry wants?
Okay. Catherine?
Thank you, Mike. Charlie, you're wrapping us up here.
All right. Thank you. Well, I'd like to thank you again, Betty, for the opportunity to kind of talk and tell you what we're doing. Our hope is that we will have a hybrid online program that aligns with Nissan as well as other local area industries and allow pieces of that to be taken out by local industries to be customized and meet their industry needs, but then be able to award them credit. So it'll be based off of that successful hybrid competency-based learning program.
Oh, okay. All right.
That's the goal. We can also allow industry to focus on the apprenticeships and work studies, because that's another key element in here that they're all very eager to join.
Again, here at Henry Ford Community College, but I have to chime in to say that we're also, interestingly enough, in that same boat of school and work paired in an active discovery of harmony, that industry is recognizing that there are improvements to be found if they can have their workers engaged in a program of study that finalizes in a certificate and or degree. And that is true with our GM battery customer. That's true with the work we're doing with Ford Motor Company at Michigan Assembly Plant. And that's true with a new program with these MAT 2 students who were hired out of high school or 1 year of college to enter into a rather rigorous 5-year program of alternating school and work for a period of 3 years. So the trend, quite interestingly enough, that seems to be true with all of us is industry is recognizing teaming education with work is good.
All right, I guess one of the questions I'm having is, how is that different from what used to be? Because we've had co-op before. We've had certification, and Henry Ford has really been in, that's one of the things that you're noted for. How is the new tech program different from what we had before? How is that, where's the distinction then?
Well, I'm probably not the one to answer that, only having been here like going into maybe 7 or 8 months. I'm not aware of the way co-op was before.
Wait a minute. You're talking to a layperson here, so don't assume that I'm interpreted correct either. Maybe some of the other ones present. Is there a difference in the way the co-op program under this program or under this grant is being implemented from what the co-op, traditional co-op experience has been prior to that? And anyone can answer that.
Well, one distinctive difference in the curriculum changes that we're implementing is the match to what it is that the industry has defined as necessary for a student partway through a particular program. What that skill set should be in the partnership with academia and industry to determine how to best deliver and then assess those skills, and then deliver a credential based on that. So that is one difference. The other being some of the systemic integration that we're looking at, how we incorporate problem solving and understanding of how systems work together for students early in the program, so that by the time they come out, they can and earlier on, not by the time they graduate with the degree, but by the time that they are going into this 14 weeks for MAT 2 at our in our classrooms, and then they do 9 weeks, I think.
It's
at their partner work site.
I thought it was actually 10 weeks. It could be 9 weeks.
Okay, and then they're doing 10 weeks, so they're expected to have certain kinds of skills to be able to understand what it is that's going on in the workplace.
Okay.
Whereas typically they might not have done that in a co-op 14 weeks into the program.
Okay. All right.
And, you know, out at a site.
Okay.
And able to identify different components of equipment and how it affects other things within the system and the work environment.
During today is that this is a really dynamic program and it's a dynamic effort. That's going to be like an evolving process, and my hats are off to all of you with that. Hopefully, since this is our first time doing this, maybe at a later time I can come back and can see where things are going and then give you a little more idea of some of the questions I have. But I really appreciate Catherine and Scott for opening the doors to me, and I appreciate all the those who participated. But I'm cutting it short now because, like I said, I know of the time frame, and I already see that we're going in 20 minutes here. So, Scott and Catherine, thank you very, very much. And I hope there's a lot I would like to ask, but like I know the time is not going to allow that. But maybe we can work out something in the future to really get some really in-depth stuff. But really, this is kind of like my listeners are really going to want to know more, and I hope I'll be able to offer that to them. So thank all of you.
Thank you, Betty, and please do check back with us.
Okay.
Yes, we'd love to tell you more.
All right, then. Okay, very good, then. All right, bye-bye.
Okay. Thank you.
The question is really to Jim Jacobs. You've been associated with Macomb Community College since 1967.
Oh,
you served as director of the Center for Workforce Development and Policy, and now you're president. So I'd like to have you think about the question as a community college president who's been deeply involved in these workforce development issues. What's the most important assets the educational system has that we can leverage for greater effect?
Well, I think community colleges play a really important role for a number of reasons. First, we are really the centerpiece for a diverse set of learners. We have young people coming out of high schools looking for careers. We have dislocated workers or individuals who have stopped working and are coming back into the workforce after periods of maybe long unemployment. And third, we also have people who are in the workforce who want to increase their talent and their skills and move upward in the companies that they currently work for or the sectors that they work for. So we're really important because we deal with all that diverse population. The second, and I think this is very important in Michigan, we're a very decentralized state in terms of our educational institutions, and we're also, I think, fairly decentralized in our employer base. What we really need to do, what way community college can serve best, is to bring kind of on a local level a consensus between business and education that would play a role in developing what are the local employment standards, what are the kinds of skill sets that are necessary to be successful in local economy.
Well, everybody talks about high unemployment. High unemployment's obviously a big problem, but it seems to me that the real problem is the skills gap, because the skills gap shows us that there are opportunities available, millions of them, in fact, and the problem seems to be that those opportunities don't get celebrated the same way the opportunities that come with a four-year degree get celebrated. This has been going on for decades, I think. There's a lot of bad advice out there, and kids hear the same steady message over and over and over and over and over and over again, right? A four-year degree is your best path to happiness, but maybe that's not true. In fact, it seems like the jobs that are available today, the really good jobs that can pay upwards of six figures, most of those require some kind of vocational background, right? And while that's a fact, we discourage a vocational background at the same time. So we're kind of disconnected from all of that, in my opinion. And it seems to me if we want to close the skills gap, we have to start valuing something in a different way. We have to start celebrating hard work and smart work at the same time. And we have to start looking at that space between blue collar and white collar as the gap into which all these jobs have fallen. We need to close that gap. And we need to start celebrating the opportunities that are available right now, today.
Problem was to just have our own training. Well, that doesn't make a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've already got great capabilities in these universities. So the way we're leveraging our assets to answer your question is by getting actively involved with those key institutions that really provide the talent to us, so that they know exactly what they want. And rather than have the top management tell what they need, we actually take the students, the three-year graduates, back to their home base and work on curriculum changes.
Hmm.
Hi, this is Amy Milan from STARS, and you're listening to WHFR 89.3 in Dearborn, Michigan, the station making waves.
This is WHFR Dearborn.
WHFR, the station making waves, proudly presents The Best of Broadway, a program featuring the best of American musical theater. Good afternoon and welcome. I'm Joe, your host. We've taken care of your tickets. Now let me escort you through 2 hours of enjoyment of The Best of Broadway. Welcome once again to The Best of Broadway. I'm Joe, your host, here on the station making waves, WHFR.FM, coming to you from the beautiful campus of Henry Ford Community College in the world-class community of Dearborn, Michigan. Today's play is Oliver, based on Charles Dickens' Oliver Twist, like a lot of plays, it's based on a novel, and it's produced by David Merrick and Donald Albury. This is the original London cast brought over from Europe. The book, music, and lyrics are written by Lionel Bart, and we're going to have, the Oliver Twist is played by Bruce Brunschnick. Nancy is played by Georgia Brown, the Alfred Dodger by Michael Goodman, and Mr. Bumble by Willoughby Goddard, Mrs. Corny by Hope Jackman. We're going to... The story of the play goes like this. Scene Act 1. The curtain opens on the sinister interior of the workhouse with a bare dining table, center stage, where the boys will sit. These pale-faced wretches can be seen peering through the bars of a door at the back. Looming above two curving stairways glows the legend, "God is love," in rough letters.